Earth brothers find the force of sound that time. The Earth goddess. Earth is a goddess. That is a living being that we share in there. The fulfillment of the spirit of Earth also. This Earth goddess toils across the sands of time to achieve immortality and eternity. The being is in her whom she hopes to her. The word speaks to her heart as she cannot bear, hear. The fate compels his form as she cannot see. In her unconscious orbit to the void, out of the mindless depths she tries to run. Turning as life again, the struggling joy. The thought that can conceive that hardly knows this is a mind. The thought that can conceive that hardly knows arises slowly in her and creates the idea, the speech that labels more than it likes. The trembling
Savitri's Jivatman, Savitri, the source of Savitri's soul, must be the Supreme Divine Mother. And if now she is rising, her psyche is rising, to be one to merge with the source, it must be rising to merge with the Supreme Divine Mother. And that approach to that is now being described, and that's why it is taking this kind of a wonderful description. Later on, you know, you have some hints, like as if Savitri feels, although this is for the first time that anyone in human body has reached this height, somehow she has a feeling that she has been here before. How does she get this feeling she has been before? Because she is an emanation of the Supreme Mother. As she, Supreme Mother, it is her Swayambham, it's her own location, her own locus. She has descended from there. She has descended from there, and therefore as Savitri, when she reaches that height, somewhere something says, this is something I have known already, in the sense, it says, as if an old remembered dream come true, she recognized in her prophetic mind the imperishable luster of that sky, the tremulous sweetness of that happy air, and covered from mind's view and life's approach, the mystic cavern in the sacred hill, and knew the dwelling of her secret soul. Now, there are many, many things here. Page 525. I wanted to get hold of a book from the library. I forgot to bring it. Volume 17. Thank you. Let us look at 525. She reaches now a stage, a realm, yet all the beginning of that page, yet all the worlds and God himself were there, for every symbol was a reality and brought the presence which had given it life. All this she saw and inly felt and knew, not by some thought of mind but by the self, a light not born of sun or moon or fire, a light that dwelt within and saw within, shedding an intimate visibility, made secrecy more revealing than the world. Now this experience, that you reach a stage where there is a light that burns, it is not visible anywhere in this earth, is described in the Upanishads. There they say the sun doesn't burn, the moon doesn't, the moon's light doesn't reach there. This is the light that burns, and because of this light, sun gets his light, or the moon gets the light that it has. So that is the original light of the Atman, of the fundamental reality that we all are. So when Savitri reaches this experience, and being an incarnation, she must be very close, but this itself is Upanishadic. This description itself, as I said, is Upanishadic, where there are descriptions. This comes in two different Upanishads. It talks about a place or an experience where there is no, the light of the sun doesn't reach, the light of the moon doesn't reach, yet it is so effulgent that you feel the sun exists on the basis of this light, etc. This is the experience of the light of the truth of the Atman. And this is something that the Upanishads have described. And for Savitri, now this entry into the world of the soul of course, has to have all these accompaniments. But I still feel there is something very special here. Made secrecy more revealing than the world. Our sight and sense are a fallible gaze and touch, and only the spirit's vision is wholly true. As thus she passed in that mysterious place, through room and room, through door and rock-hewn door, she felt herself made one with all she saw. A sealed identity within her woke. She knew herself the beloved of the Supreme. These gods and goddesses were he and she. The mother was she of beauty and delight. The world in Brahma's vast creating clasp. The world puissance on almighty Shiva's lap. The master and mother of all lives. Watching the worlds that twin regard had made. Amid Krishna and Krishna and Radha forever entwined in bliss. The adorer and adored, self-lost and one. In the last chamber, on a golden seat, one sat, whose shape no vision could define. Only one felt the world's unattainable fount, a power of which she was a straying force, an invisible beauty, goal of the world's desire, a sun of which all knowledge is a beam, a greatness without whom no life could be. This to me is a description of the supramental, the gnosis, the final center of the Gnostic consciousness, and Savitri now reaches that point. And as you can see, talks about Brahma and Vishnu and Krishna and so on. And strangely enough, there is a reference in one of Sri Aurobindo's earlier writings. In his volume 17, The Hour of God, there is a section called The Web of Yoga, where he says, the one is four forever in a supramental quaternary of being, consciousness, force and ananda. Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, Krishna, these are the eternal four, the quadruple infinite. He says these are the four powers of the supramental consciousness, one represented as Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva and Krishna. Brahma is the eternal personality of existence. From him all is created, by his presence, by his power, by his impulse. Vishnu is the eternal personality of consciousness. In him all is supported, in his wideness, in his stability, in his substance. Shiva is the eternal personality of force. Through him all is created, through his passion, through his rhythm, through his concentration. Krishna is the eternal personality of ananda. Because of him all creation is possible, because of his play, because of his delight, because of his sweetness. Brahma is immortality, Vishnu is eternity, Shiva is infinity, Krishna is the Supreme's eternal, infinite, immortal self-play, self-issuing, self-manifesting, self-finding. This is a passage which has some bearing on the description here, where Savitri finds Krishna, Shiva, Brahma, etc. But this is another indication in the case that the supramental quaternary, they are saying, there are the four forces or four godheads or four powers of the supramental. And it seems to me this is where Savitri really reaches the very source of this. And then of course after that Sri Aurobindo moves away a little bit and talks about your yoga and my yoga as well. When the psychic being in us rises and is ready to meet the Jivatman, what exactly happens? That is described in the next section on page 526. A being stood immortal in transience, deathless dallying with momentary things, in whose wide eyes of tranquil happiness, which pity and sorrow could not abrogate, infinity turned its gaze on finite shapes. Observer of the silent steps of the hours, eternity upheld the minute's acts and the passing scenes of the everlasting's play. In the mystery of its selecting will, in the divine comedy a participant, the spirit's conscious representative, God's delegate in our humanity. Comrade of the universe, the transcendent's ray, this is the Jivatman, she had come into the mortal body's room to play at ball with time and circumstance. This soul comes into the mortal body's room. How does she come? She sends an emanation, and that becomes the psychic, later on it is a psychic being, and she describes it a few lines down as a mother feels and shares her children's lives. She puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of man. This is how the Upanishads describe the size of the shape and size of your soul. I don't know why, there must be some significance to it. She puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of man, into a hidden region of the heart, hidden region of the heart. Now, as a result of it, many people think that soul is a kind of a locket you wear somewhere within. So soul must be like this. But Upanishads dispel your confusion about this by saying your body, the body doesn't contain the soul contains the body. So it's all over. Atman is all over. Atman is that reality. You see, our human minds have always somehow, unless something is finite, we don't think it is real. So anything, Sri Aurobindo talks about it in the Life Divine. One of the things that matter has in its favor, matter is finite, and so anything that you and I think real is always has this finite form. So we think soul also must be, otherwise the people ask the question. Today India's population is more than how many, what is it, there are some, it comes in the TV every day. More than? Yes, whatever. Where did the souls come from? Is there a mint that God maintains and, you know, sends them periodically, and when there is confusion he withdraws all this? What happens? You know, these very serious minded people ask, how come suddenly the population increased, and if each person has a soul, the supply must be, you know, correspondingly increase, so God must send, you know, like suddenly you find a shortage of small coins and you write an application to the mint and the market is flooded with 5 rupee notes, 2 rupee notes, like that. So is there a God's mint where souls are kind of minted and then supplied and withdrawn? This is a very interesting concept. This is because we think even soul has to be finite. We can't believe that the soul is real without being finite, without being of a particular form. Soul is that spirit where from one we have all come, and ultimately India's population may be in billions, but how many Atmans exist in India? Only one. What kind of a reality is this? We find it difficult to believe. Therefore, these kinds of descriptions that the Divine has put, this little angushtamatram, that kind of a shape and form somewhere secret in our hearts, a beautiful description to indicate the center of your consciousness is deep down there, that's what it means, rather than it limits it by this description. So, she puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of man, into a hidden region of the heart, to face the pang and to forget the bliss, to share the suffering and endure earth's wounds and labor mid the labor of the stars. This in us laughs and weeps, suffers the stroke, exults in victory, struggles for the crown, identified with the mind and body and life, It takes on itself their anguish and defeat, bleeds with fate's whips, and hangs upon the cross. Yet in the ill, the unwounded and immortal self, supporting the actor in the human scene. Nobody can distill the Upanishads like Sri Aurobindo and put them in 8 lines. He says, in spite of all these things, the soul is asnaviram, it's ever blameless, ever unwounded, ever always whole, although it participates in this life, and in sympathy with the body and the mind, it weeps, it cries, it gives you all this impression, but the soul itself, the psychic being itself, is never contaminated, sin doesn't touch it, impurities don't touch it, it's always pure. This is what the Upanishads have described, and Sri Aurobindo has all put it down into, you know, in the 8-10 lines, the whole philosophy, the whole vision of the Upanishads. It's a beautiful lines. This in us laughs and weeps, suffers the stroke, exults in victory, struggles for the crown. Identified with the mind and body and life, it takes on itself their anguish and defeat, bleeds with fate's whips and hangs upon the cross, yet is the unwounded and immortal self, supporting the actor in the human scene. Through this she sends us her glory and her powers, pushes to wisdom's heights through misery's gulfs. She gives us strength to do our daily task, and sympathy that partakes of others' grief, and the little strength we have to help our race. We who must fill the role of the universe, acting itself out in a slight human shape, and on our shoulders carry the struggling world. This is in us, the Godhead, small and marred. In this human portion of divinity, she sees the greatness of the soul in time. Psychic is the soul in time. The Jivatman is beyond time. The psychic is its emanation, which exists in time, which develops in time, and has the experience that we gather through time. She sees the greatness of the soul in time, to uplift from life to life, from power to power, till on a heavenly peak it stands, a king. When it is, it completes its journey, it stands on the peak, a king, samrat. It is the emperor. In body weak, in its heart an invisible might, it climbs tumbling, held by an unseen hand. Which is this unseen hand? As a psychic is climbing, it sometimes stumbles, and yet it is held by an unseen hand. There is, in Nashupati's Yoga, Sri Aurobindo describes this outstretched hand that is always at our back. No matter what happens, no matter how miserable you think you are, how much you feel you are on the long line, there is always this unseen hand, and he says this unseen hand has been behind you, not only in this life, ever since this series of your lives began. It is the unseen hand of the Jivatman. He always guides you, protects you, and he guides you. But how do we fall? Why do we fall and break our limbs? The only answer to it is, sometimes falling and breaking your limbs is good for you. Otherwise there cannot be. For us, good is that which always pushes us to the bank. More money, more worldly success, that's we want. But Jivatman has other ideas for us. Jivatman is that part in us which is always conscious that we are deserving of the crown of conscious immortality. He says, you are amrutasya putraha, you are children of immortality. You have to rise to that height, and not beggars for happiness. Where do I get some happiness? Here, there, Singapore, in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, or London, or New York. Where can I get some happiness? And you have exhausted all the markets. Your money is almost broke. Your back is broken because the things you have brought, you are carrying on your back and you can't carry anymore, yet your zest for shopping for happiness is not finished. Because, as Upanishads tell us, nalpe sukhamasti, there is no happiness in the finite. Even if you own the British Museum, I don't know where the Kohinoor jewels are now, even if you own all that, nalpe sukhamasti, because the person seated within you is a spark of the infinite. And the only way to satisfy him is by clinging on to the eternal verities, not to the finite. And so, it is this Jivatman and his wisdom that saves us from too much success. Too much success can also be bad for your spiritual journey. He gives you as much success as it is necessary for your spiritual journey, and then gives you a slight bitter dose so that your digestion becomes all right. So this is all is controlled by the Jivatman. So this is what he is talking about. In body weak, in its heart an invincible might, it climbs stumbling, held up by an unseen hand. A toiling spirit in a mortal shape. Here, now, giving you all that happens in ordinary people like you and me, the psychic being, it struggles, what it tries to do, he goes back to what he was talking about, Savitri's journey. Here in this chamber of flame and light they met. They looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity in its human part. After all, this human emanation, the psychic, came from the Jivatman. So the secret deity and its human part, the calm immortal and the struggling soul. Then with a magic transformation speed, they rushed into each other and grew one. This is what gives you the experience of being universal. The Jivatman never loses the sense that there are other Jivatmans who have also emanated, also come from the Supreme Mother. When you become the psychic being, individualized in time, this awareness of your universal existence is lost. Only when you become one with the Jivatman, this awareness comes back to you. And that is what is happening here. I think we have some time, but the passage I want to read, maybe we should read that, because Prabhupada is just leaving, so she will take about 10 minutes to have the drink ready. Okay, now as a result of this, something happens, and this is what I was referring to as the descent of the Mahakundalini. Comes into all the centers of Savitri's being. As you know, Sri Aurobindo has said that his yoga combines the Vedantic with the Tantric. He begins with the Vedantic, but at some stage the Tantric yoga is also embraced. Of course, the set practices of Tantricism are eschewed, we don't need them. But some of the central mechanisms of the Tantric yoga, for example, turning to the mother, the Shakti, because she is the creatrix, it is she who can bring out the new world. And the other yogas, the Vedantic yogas, are more intent on leaving the ship and running away. The Tantric yogas are not in a hurry to leave the world. They want to possess the world. They want to make the world worth possessing, enjoy the world, etc. That is, they have claimed, but they didn't exactly know how to do it. Sri Aurobindo combines these, so here it is a Tantric, and just as there is the rising of the Kundalini, in Sri Aurobindo there is rising, but it first begins with the descent. And you don't do any practices meant to stir your Kundalini, because that's a very dangerous enterprise. Your Kundalini can rise, because many of the yogic siddhis can come to you even when the patra is not ready, even when the receptacle is not pure or it's not ready, and when the siddhis come, they can, instead of bringing you bliss and felicity, can bring you intense torture and suffering. This has happened to some people. The kundalini rose, but it rose, it started going up through the wrong channels, and what should have been an experience of moonlight passing through your nerves became the experience of boiling hot oil climbing through your nerves. Is that very pleasant? Hot oil, boiling hot oil going through your nerves. That's because the kundalini didn't rise, didn't go the right way. All these things can happen. People can go mad, and this has also happened. Because purity, you cannot compromise with one thing in yoga. Purity is absolutely essential. If there is no purity, but only ambition to be a yogi, you pull it down and there is no purity and you are completely damaged. This can happen. All these things are eschewed here by not making you ambitious, leaving it to the Divine in her judgment, in her wisdom, to give you what you are ready for, in the measure you are ready for it, and not make you far too ambitious. So here also, there is a descent. You know, in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, one of the fundamental processes is a descent. You and I, all the sadhak does is to keep the patra pure and open. And then the descent takes place. Descent of knowledge, descent of light, descent of power, all these things descend. Here too, the kundalini descends, the maha kundalini descends, and this time it brings two various parts of Savitri's being, the power and light and bliss of the supramental, and pervades the whole being of Savitri. So here it is described on page 528. Let's read it from the beginning, 4-5 lines. Right from 527, where a new section begins. Once more she was human upon earthly soil. All this experience Savitri had of her psychic becoming one with the Supreme Divine Mother, all this an inner experience, probably she had it in some kind of a trance. This can only happen in the sleep of the physical body. It can't happen when the physical body is awake. Now that trance had passed, and Savitri once more, she was human upon earthly soil. In the muttering night amid the rain-wept woods and the rude cottage where she sat in trance, that subtle world withdrew deeply within, behind the sun veil of the inner sight. But now, the half-opened lotus bud of her heart had bloomed and stood disclosed to the earthly ray. In an image shone, revealed her secret soul. There was no wall severing the soul and mind, no mystic fence guarding from the claims of life. In its deep lotus home her being sat, as if on concentration's marble seat, calling the mighty mother of the worlds to make this earthly tenement her house. Her whole being was calling the divine, the path, the supreme new consciousness to descend into her. As in a flash from a supernal light, a living image of the original power, a face, a form, came down into her heart and made of it its temple and pure abode. But when its feet had touched the quivering bloom, a mighty movement rocked the inner space, as if a world were shaken and found its soul out of the inconscient, soulless, mindless night. A flaming serpent rose, released from sleep. It rose billowing its coils and stood erect, and climbing mightily, stormily on its way, it touched her centers with its flaming mouth, as if a fiery kiss had broken their sleep. They bloomed and laughed, surcharged with light and bliss. Then at the crown it joined the eternal space. in the flower of the head, in the flower of matter space, in each divine stronghold and nature knot. It held together the mystic stream which joins the viewless summits with the unseen depths. The string of forks that make the frail defense, safeguarding us against the enormous world, our lines of self-expression in its vast. An image sat of the original power, wearing the mighty mother's form and face, armed bearer of the weapon and the sign, whose occult might no magic can imitate. Manifold at once she sat, a guardian force, a savior gesture, stretched her lifted arm, and symbol of some native cosmic strength, a sacred beast lay prone below her feet, a silent flame-eyed mass of living force, all underwent a high celestial change, breaking the black inconscience, my blind mute wall, effacing the circles of the ignorance, fires and divinities burst flaming forth, each part of the being trembling with delight, lay overwhelmed with tides of happiness, and saw her hand in every circumstance, and felt her touch in every limb and cell. In the country of the lotus of the head, which thinking mind has made its busy space, in the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, whence it shoots the arrows of its sight and will, in the passage of the lotus of the throat, where speech must rise and the expressing mind and the heart's impulse run towards word and act, a glad uplift and a new working came. I don't think anybody else has written like this, with such power and force, the descent of the Mahakundalini with a special force. And I would like to think that this is the descent of the supramental in Savitri. It's not the ordinary Kundalini descending or ascending. And since the passage is so powerful, I think we need to take a little break. And we'll do that. Before I do that, I have great pleasure in announcing that some of our friends in Andhra Pradesh of this canto, Canto 5, describes how slowly and gradually the whole being of Savitri is pervaded by the powers that come down, the descent of Kundalini, and all parts of her being are transformed. And we saw a little bit of it earlier on, and read just one or two more excerpts and then move on. Page 529, line 271, about 9-10 lines from the bottom of that page. A channel of the mighty mother's choice, the immortal's will, took into its calm control our blind or erring government of life. A lute republic once of wants and needs, then bowed to the uncertain sovereign mind, life now obeyed to a diviner rule, and every act became an act of God. Just normally, in the state of ignorance, our life is governed by the vital, and the vital, as we know, is the seat of desires. And now the vital itself is transformed, every part of our being is transformed, and it says life now obeyed to a diviner rule, and every act became an act of God. In the kingdom of the lotus of the heart, love chanting its pure hymeneal hymn made life and body mirrors of sacred joy, and all the emotions gave themselves to God. In the navel lotus broad imperial range, what is called the Nabhi Padma here, its proud ambitions and its master lusts were tamed into instruments of a great calm sway to do a work of God on earthly soil. In the narrow nearer center's petty parts, its childish game of daily dwarf desires was changed into a sweet and boisterous play, a romp of little gods with life in time. And the lower center, the Muladhara, in the deep place where once the serpent slept, there came a grip on matter's giant powers for large utilities in life's little space. A firm ground was made for heaven's descending might. Well, we conclude this canto by looking at the last few lines. And how does Savitri feel at this experience? That's described in 531, line 327, middle of that page. Then lifts the mind a cry of victory. O soul, my soul, we have created heaven. We have created heaven. Within we have found the kingdom here of God. His fortress built in a loud, ignorant world. This is in fact the goal of the supramental yoga, building here the perfection of heaven. Within we have found the kingdom here of God, his fortress built in a loud, ignorant world. Our life is entrenched between two rivers of light. We have turned space into a gulf of peace and made the body a capital of bliss. What more, if more must still be done? In the slow process of the evolving spirit, in the brief stage between a death and birth, a first perfection stage is reached at last. Out of the wood and stone of our nature stuff, a temple is shaped where the high gods could live. Even if the struggling world is left outside, one man's perfection still can save the world. There is one new proximity to the skies, a first betrothal of the earth to heaven, a deep concordat between truth and life. A camp of God is pitched in human time. This is how this wonderful canto ends. A camp of God is pitched in human time. Each time a person reaches this perfection, it is like a camp of God. It is from here. Gradually and slowly, the effect of the supramental will spread all over the world, and this atmosphere will give the gods in our consciousness to gain in strength, and they will be able to vanquish the adversary forces that are playing havoc with the life around. So this is now one person's gain, Savitri's gain, and as you can see, this does not fulfill the ultimate demands of our yoga. It is not one person's perfection that is aimed, but the person's perfection is the preliminary step that has to be taken. So Savitri has reached that perfection. What remains now is to make that universally acceptable, accessible. Collectivity should be able to participate in it. How do we do that? Well, this is where most yogas have miserably failed. Yogas have achieved more or less success at the individual's level, but when they wanted to include a collectivity, somehow, whether it is the Buddhistic collectivity or the collectivity of our ashrams, etc., the collective consciousness seems to be too diffuse, too conflicting, etc. Changing it is very, very difficult. And now, the rest of it is two more cantos here, is Savitri's effort to be an effective channel through which this new force will be able to descend and spread itself gradually all around her until the whole of humanity is comprehended, the whole of humanity is touched by it. So this is the attempt, and in fact, as we said some time ago in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, the beginning may be the individual's yoga, individual's siddhi, but that doesn't take you to the final goal. And the reason for this simply is, we are all connected, just as we are all one at the apex of creation, at the superconscient level, we are also all one at the rock bottom of the inconscient. I have parts of my being all connected at this root to which everybody's being is connected. And therefore, accept the only way is for me to cut off all relationships and go like a kite flying into the sky of nirvana. But if I want to be here, then I have no choice but to pay attention to the roots, and it is at these roots that we are all interconnected. And therefore, the perfection of the collectivity becomes a part of the perfection of the individual as well. And therefore, you must be wondering why the mother and Sri Aurobindo wanted or allowed the ashram to grow up. The mother herself said that one time they did not know how to go about it. So why they thought maybe they should first go up and do and bring it down and do all the work, and then like distribute it to others, as the mother once used to distribute soup. Then they found it was not possible. And she said this decision was taken over by the Divine Himself. We didn't have to decide it. The Second World War came. Many people came here with their children. And lo and behold, gradually the community grew and became the ashram subsequently. And they had some, there are some